is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The American way being sorely tested right now. Zacharias Moussaoui, the guy who most people figure was the 19th or 20th hijacker, or whatever the number was, the missing hijacker, because he got arrested before 9/11. But he had been to flight school. He had been all these things. He has, back in October, he testified under oath in court for an ongoing investigation, actually for a lawsuit. There's this lawsuit from some 9/11 families against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and some Saudi individuals. And Moussaoui testified that, well, here's the story of today's New York Times. Moussaoui calls Saudi princes patrons of Al-Qaeda. According to him, a bunch of Saudi princes basically paid for 9/11. And he was one of the guys who was supposed to fly one of the planes. Scott Shane writing for the New York Times today. By the way, let me back up just a little bit and provide you with the largest frame on this. We are watching the world, in shock and horror, and the United States as well, as Fox News has put up the unedited video of this Jordanian pilot being burned to death. Brilliant move, Fox News. Fox so-called news. I mean, I understand why they do it. It's horrible, and it stokes the be afraid meme. It makes Americans freak out and think, oh, my God, they're going to come to my neighborhood and do that to me or my kids. And, oh, yeah, sure, I salute the Republican Party and their larger defense budgets. But really what this all goes back to is George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, when they became president and vice president in January of 2001, Bill Clinton met with George W. Bush, Al Gore met with Dick Cheney, and Sandy Berger? Yeah, was the national security chief, met with Condoleezza Rice. And if I'm remembering Sandy Berger's name right, he on this program, back, what, 6 years ago, something like that, he told you, that he had personally told Condoleezza Rice, your number one worry is going to be Osama bin Laden. He's trying to get the United States. And he told us on the air that Al Gore said the same thing to Dick Cheney, and that Bill Clinton said the same thing to George W. Bush. And all three of them, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice, all of them said to their respective, the people who held their office before, their respective predecessors, I guess would be the word, said, that was Bill Clinton's obsession. We're not going to pursue that. We're really concerned more about Saddam Hussein in Iraq. This is, truly grim stuff. And I would submit to you that had they listened to the Clintons, had they listened to their own people, to Richard Clark, to the CIA, to British intelligence, to German intelligence, to Russian intelligence, to Israeli intelligence, had they bothered to listen, there would be no ISIS today. There would be no burning to death of a Jordanian pilot, no beheading of Japanese workers. There would be none of this stuff. There would be no ISIS. Arguably, there would be no Al-Qaeda by now. This is, like, I think this is the biggest piece of this story that is not being told in the American media. Nobody points out how this all started. Sunday, October 14th, 2001. This is 6 weeks after 9/11. 5 weeks after 9/11, 4.5 weeks after 9/11. Kathy Gannon, writing for the Associated Press, published on the Washington Post. You can easily find it. Just plug Washington Post, you know, Bush rejects Taliban offer, and you'll, it'll pop right up. The headline, in fact, is Bush rejects Taliban bin Laden offer. And Kathy Gannon writes, a senior Taliban leader said Sunday that the Islamic militia would be willing to hand over Osama bin Laden to a third country if the United States halts the bombing of Afghanistan and provides evidence against him. Next paragraph, one sentence, six words. President Bush quickly rejected the offer. So you got this? The Taliban says, we will arrest bin Laden. We will put him out of business. We will send him to a third country where he can be tried. And in fact, what they were specifically suggesting, the meeting, by the way, it was the Taliban foreign minister. His name was Walil Ahmed Muktawakil. And this was a secret meeting in Islamabad. And he offered to put bin Laden in custody of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC. Now, if the judges of the OIC, a completely Muslim organization representing Muslim states, if the judges of the OIC had found bin Laden guilty and sentenced him to death or imprisonment for 9/11, we never would have had a war in Afghanistan. We never would have had a war in Iraq. Al-Qaeda would have been crushed. It would have had 1,000 times more credibility than us doing anything, because it would be Muslim Arabs condemning a Muslim Arab. But George W. Bush wanted to have a war. Specifically, he wanted to have a war in Iraq. The war in Afghanistan was just, frosting on the cake. He figured, hey, it's the second poorest country in the world. This is going to be just like Ronald Reagan going in and taking out Grenada. You know, it'll last a week or two. No big deal. It's going to be easy. Right. You know, Thomas Jefferson said something about slavery that I think applies to this. He said, you know, we have a wolf by the ears and we don't know how to safely let him go or how to safely continue to hold him. And that's where we're at with Iraq. And we never needed to pick that wolf up by the ears. So now where it gets really interesting is what... You know, none of this would be happening if it wasn't for Bush and Cheney. Let's not forget that. It is in none of the contextual setups from any of the networks or any of the news organizations about what's going on. All of this is the result of George W. Bush. But secondly, what Massawi said, and this, reading from the New York Times, he said that he was directed in 98 or 99 by al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan to create a digital database of donors to al-Qaeda. Among those, he said, he recalled listing in the database were Prince Turki al-Faisal, the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the longtime Saudi ambassador to the United States. That's the guy we refer to as Bandar Bush, because he virtually lived with the Bush family. And Prince al-Walid bin Talal, a prominent billionaire investor and many of the country's leading clerics. Prince al-Walid bin Talal, up until last year, was the second largest stockholder in Fox News. He has reduced his holdings in Fox News from over 6% to around 1%. But he's still one of the major stockholders in Fox News. Why does the headline not say, 20th hijacker says that Fox News stockholder was involved in funding 9/11?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mr. Massawi said he acted as a courier for bin Laden, carrying personal messages to prominent Saudi princes. Really? I got to tell you what Bob Graham has to say about this after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Fred watching Free Speech TV in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Fred.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. How are you today?
I am great. How are you?
Unbelievable. You got me all excited here.
Okay.
I had heard about the Saudi connection on Democracy Now! This morning, and I think it's so important to get the word out to American people and have us see what has been going on. And you're going back to Bush and Cheney. What you said reminded me, concerning the Jordanian pilot who was burned alive.
Right.
And horrendous as that is, and it really is horrendous. But I had occasion in the aftermath of Charlie Hebdo to do a little research, and I was reading a part of Jeremy Scahill's Dirty Wars again, and the report on the missile strike in, I forget the name of the little village in Yemen, in which over 40 women and children were killed.
Right.
And we denied it. The Yemeni government initially took credit for the strike, and a journalist went and found out that there were American missile parts lying around. Right. And the description, Tom, was terrible. You know, mixture of animal and human flesh that could not be identified as which was which.
Right.
Flesh stuck to the sides of trees. And I just want somebody to tell me what is worse, burning one guy who was bombing them alive or destroying 40 women and children
right. For
no use.
Well, this is brutality breeds brutality. And
yeah. They
have been the victims of, now you could argue they were the perpetrators of some pretty brutal violence, but I would submit to you that had we never invaded Iraq or Afghanistan, there would be no ISIS. These guys, Bin Laden was studying economics, working on his MBA when Reagan basically said, "Hey, you wanna fight the Soviets? I'll give you some money." You know, I mean, we created these things.
We've been creating a time for a century at least.
Yeah.
With in the aftermath of World War I and the way the Middle East was carved up, right through the creation of Israel, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran,
right,
the support of the Shah for a quarter century when he was brutalizing people,
right.
we provided Saddam
right
with
yeah.
materials to make chemical weapons,
right, and we provided him with the satellite stats on where the Iranian soldiers were so he could use those chemical weapons.
Yeah.
And that was during the Reagan administration.
What's so important, I think, is, you know, we can't undo that, but we can stand up and say, this is what was going on. I am truly sorry. President Obama's, we tortured some people, and then going on is not enough. We have to stand up, look the camera in the eye, and say, we have done some dastardly things. You have done some dastardly things. Let us sit down and end this insanity.
Yes. I agree, and I don't see that happening, tragically, and I think that this president has fallen under the sway of the military-industrial complex, too. Fred, thanks for the call. Your point's all well taken. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. It's the place where smart people get the news. The Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars. It seems to me that what's the old saying? I think it was George Santanaya who said, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. Or, I don't know, who some old philosopher. And here we are. I mean, we're forgetting that we invented Al-Qaeda in order to throw the Soviets out of Afghanistan. We brought Bin Laden into this thing and paid his way. We ignored him under the Bush administration for 9 months until he struck us on 9/11, which he had basically told us he was going to do. And this was willful dereliction of duty, arguably, by Dick Cheney and George W. Bush. Bush took the longest vacation in the history of the American presidency. Went down to Crawford, Texas for almost a month. And then when his vacation was over and he was supposed to return to Washington, D.C., and he was getting all this intelligence that there was a strike coming on Washington and New York, he was afraid to go back to D.C., George W. Bush. I mean, the CIA actually had, they had one of their guys fly down to Crawford, Texas to hand deliver the August 6th presidential daily briefing that was headlined, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the U.S. And George W. Bush patted the guy on the butt or on the knee, one or the other, and said, okay, you've covered your ass, go back to Washington, D.C. It's a pretty much verbatim quote. Also filed, by the way, on Monday, this all goes back to this lawsuit by survivors of 9/11 who are suing the Saudis. Again, from the New York Times, the New York piece, the headline, Massawi calls Saudi princes patrons of al-Qaeda by Scott Shane in today's New York Times. Also filed on Monday in the survivors lawsuit were affidavits from former Senators Bob Graham of Florida. Was he a Republican or a Democrat? Oh, he might have been a Democrat. In any case, and Bob Kerry of Nebraska, and the former Navy Secretary John Lehman. These are substantial names. You know, Graham and Kerry were on the 9/11 Commission, arguing that more investigation was needed into Saudi ties to the 9/11 plot. Mr. Graham was co-chairman of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into the attacks, and Mr. Kerry and Mr. Lehman served on the 9/11 Commission. Mr. Graham said, quote, I am convinced that there was a direct line between at least some of the terrorists who carried out this 9/11 attacks and the government of Saudi Arabia, wrote Mr. Graham, who has long demanded the release of 28 pages of the congressional report on the attacks that explore Saudi connections and therefore remain classified. Mr. Kerry said in the affidavit that it was fundamentally inaccurate and misleading to argue that the 9/11 Commission exonerated the Saudi government. But let's go back even farther. I mean, the intelligence failures, and I realize there's a discussion about whether this was even an intelligence failure. Right? 2 years before George W. Bush put Dick Cheney in charge of counterterrorism, the counterterrorism task force, that was in January 2001. And this was, they were throwing a bone to Sandy Berger and Al Gore and Bill Clinton saying, yeah, okay, we'll look into bin Laden. We'll create a counterterrorism task force. We're going to put the vice president in charge of it. Cheney was in charge of the counterterrorism task force, and he was in charge of the energy task force. The energy task force started meeting immediately. No environmentalists allowed, just oil industry barons. And what were they doing? They were dividing up Western Iraq, the oil fields, the unexplored or unexploited oil fields of Western Iraq, creating maps and spreadsheets of what countries and what companies they would sell the Iraqi oil to once they had attacked Iraq. Now, this was in January and February of 2001, before 9/11. And you'll recall that George W. Bush's brother Jeb signed a letter in 1998 to President Bill Clinton over the letterhead of the committee, the Project for a New American Century, saying that a new Pearl Harbor would be necessary to motivate and bring the American people into line with their thinking. But if that were to happen, then the time has come to invade Iraq and take down Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein, who represented absolutely no threat to the United States, but Iraq, as Dick Cheney famously said, over and over and over again, and we get the clip of it around here someplace. He said Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves, very significant reserves. And not only is it 10% of the world's oil, it's some of the cheapest oil on earth. So, you know, the question has been asked when Bush went to Crawford with all these alarm, you know, code red, you know, sirens going off, Richard Clark running around with his hair on fire, everybody saying, oh my God, Dick Cheney's counterterrorism task force had not yet met, not even once, in August when Bush went on vacation. And after his vacation, he was so afraid to go back to D.C., I think because, you know, he'd been told, hey, something's going to happen. We don't know what, but it's not safe, that he went to the state that his brother was the governor of, Florida, Jeb Bush, and Jeb Bush put the entire state on lockdown, declared a state of emergency for Florida. And thus, George W. is sitting in a second grade class reading My Pet Goat as 9/11 happens. And then he goes hopscotching around state to state, scared to death that these guys are coming after him. But then we can take it back to Reagan. Reagan was so fond of these Islamic jihadists, he gave them $5 billion of taxpayer money. He invited them to the White House. He called them freedom fighters. One of those guys, not one of the ones who came to the White House, but one of the guys who was there, one of the Mujahideen fighters, was Osama bin Laden. He got his start by joining the Mujahideen that was funded by Reagan and the CIA. Before that, he was studying to get a degree in econ and business administration from a Saudi Arabian college. The BBC in 2004 claimed that bin Laden himself wasn't just supported by Reagan, he was given military training by Reagan's CIA. When are we going to point this stuff out?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Is it time to have a trial for the Bush war criminals and to put on the record Reagan's role in this? Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Oh, this is nuts. Debug is blogging over at Daily Kos. In, you know, the motto of the United States is e pluribus unum, out of one, or out of many, one. Right? Out of diversity comes one nation, out of many people comes one nation. E pluribus unum. It's Latin. Most states have a Latin motto that is translated into English. And Vermont doesn't have one. Vermont's motto is in English. It's called freedom and unity. And so some eighth graders in Vermont studying Latin, which, by the way, is a dead language. I mean, you know, some Catholics use it for mass, but that's about it. I took 2 years of it. I mean, in high school, it was a prerequisite for college. But, it, you know, and it was very useful. But, hey, it's Latin. So anyhow, she proposes a Latin motto for Vermont, Stella Quarta Decima Fulgiet. The translation, may the 14th star shine bright. This is, you know, Vermont was the 14th state to join the Union. It's nice. It's poetic, as Debug points out. So the legislature, so then a local TV station did a story about it and asked, what do you think about a Latin motto for the state? The question was, one state senator thinks Vermont should have a Latin motto. What do you think? And then, as Debug points out, the crazies came out of the woodwork. Here are some of the responses. If you live in the United States, you need to learn English. Here's another one. Vermont ain't no Latino area. Here's another one. This is America, not Mexico or some other Latin American country. Right. Apparently, these people don't know what Latin is, much less what E pluribus unum is. And, you know, anyhow. Okay, that, other news, Tom Wheeler, chairman of the FCC, just hours ago, tweeted out, it's time to put in place rules to preserve the open Internet that has become an indispensable part of our daily lives. He says, I am submitting to my colleagues the strongest open Internet protection ever proposed by the FCC. These enforceable bright line rules will ban paid prioritization and the blocking and throttling of lawful content and services. How's he going to do that? He's going to invoke Title II, which is what we have been asking for all along. So this is great news. We'll see if he can hold up. I mean, just mind-boggling amounts of money and pressure are now going to be coming down on the head of Tom Wheeler and the other FCC commissioners. And keep in mind, he's got two Democrats and two Republicans, as I recall, or maybe three Republicans and two Democrats in addition to him. And it's going to be real interesting to see where this goes. So, anyhow, John in Chicago. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to refer to diagonal drilling that was happening. I'm not sure the Arab country involved that was in cahoots with a big oil interest, U.S. oil interest, to drill 2 miles down. That was considered new technology in the late 90s, being able to go right. 2 miles down, diagonal drilling.
You're talking about Kuwait. And, that's how Kuwait was stealing Iraq's oil, which is why Saddam invaded Kuwait.
Okay, I don't know if it was Arab Emirates or the geography I'm not right on. But
yeah, it's Kuwait.
So it was Kuwait, and that was the whole basis of why they had a problem with Kuwait. And That's something, and I love the way you put the chronology out there. I wish there was that kind of succinct chronology going down to say, okay, in August of 2000, this was said prior to the election and Jeb Bush's letter. I didn't hear that before.
Yeah.
The diagonal drilling really was a big deal to Saddam Hussein. It was like stealing.
Yeah, and, no, it was stealing, and he went to April Gillespie, our ambassador to Iraq, or our it wasn't an we didn't have an official embassy there, but it was she was like the person representing us, and said, you know, I'm going to go after the Kuwaitis. Do you guys have a problem? And she was basically, it's not our business. And so he invaded Kuwait, and so George Herbert Walker Bush is president at the time, and he gets the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to come in and pretend that she's like a nurse or something from Kuwait. And talks about babies being thrown out of preemies being thrown out of incubators in the hospitals, which never happened. And all of a sudden, the U.S. Congress is voting to authorize all this money and power to George Herbert Walker Bush so he can have a little war in Iraq. And he had a little war. It only lasted 100 hours. It was a 3-day war to push Saddam Hussein and his forces out of Kuwait. But he didn't want to go any farther than the Iraqi border. And because the war was so short, as George W. Bush pointed out to his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, in 99, because the war was so short, by the time the election came around, that halo effect of being a wartime president had faded for George Herbert Walker Bush, and he failed to get reelected. And George W. Bush said he wasn't going to make that same mistake. You've got the Cindy Sheehan clip of this, And we've got the Cheney, Iraq has 10% of the world's oil. John, thank you for the call. Here's what Dick Cheney had. Is this Cheney? Yeah. Here's what Dick Cheney had to say.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
There you go. And the other clip? Okay, here it goes.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. That's George W. Bush. A year before he ran for president, saying, "I'm not going to have a short war like my dad did." That didn't work out that well for him. "I want to privatize Social Security in my second term. I want to have a legacy. I'm going to have a successful presidency by having a real war." Right. Joe in Chicago Heights. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Calling a comment on whenever the 9/11 issue comes up, how it just infuriates me in that when Bush and Cheney got into office, they had one primary goal, and that was to take as much public taxpayer money and privatize it to the maximum that they could.
Yeah, and especially for Halliburton, because if I can just fill in, Joe, one little piece here. When Dick Cheney became the CEO of Halliburton, one of the first things he did was authorize the acquisition of Dresser Industries. Halliburton at that time was a profitable company. Dresser Industries had a huge asbestos liability problem that dated back to the 1930s. And when he acquired Dresser Industries, he was betting that the federal government would resolve the asbestos lawsuits that were stacked up in court in a way that would not cost Dresser Industries a lot of money. Well, in 99, I think it was, the federal government did come to a resolution on asbestos. And I know this because my dad had mesothelioma and was part of that lawsuit. And the resolution that they came to basically bankrupted Dresser Industries, which bankrupted Halliburton. Halliburton was within a few months of bankruptcy when Dick Cheney became vice president of the United States. And he owned hundreds of thousands of shares of Halliburton stock, and he had been the CEO who destroyed the company. So, gee, all of a sudden, Halliburton's getting no-bid contracts all around the world, and now they're a multi-billion-dollar company. Back to you, Joe.
Yes, and one of their primary goals was to resurrect the failed missile defense system, which cost us $1 trillion during Reagan's presidency.
Right, Star Wars.
Right. So part of to do that, they needed to advocate that our major threat was a rogue missile from a country like North Korea and not some low-tech overland terrorist like Bin Laden. So they were just bent on mitigating the Bin Laden threat and creating this false threat of North Korea and rogue missiles coming in.
So yeah, and I would argue, Joe, that same thinking, the neocon thinking behind that, the defense industry thinking behind that, the contractor thinking and lobbying and money and buying of politicians behind that is the same thing that's being played out right now in relationship to the United States and Russia, and which concerns me tremendously. And Ukraine and Iran, I mean, this is you know, John McCain wanting to have war with Iran, same thing. So, yeah, excellent point. Thank you for the call, Joe. Excellent point. Kay in Bay City, Michigan. Hey, Kay, what's up?
Hi. Unfortunately, I only get to listen to you if I'm in the car with Sirius, but I'm always fascinated. But today I sat in the driveway for the longest time. I'm totally, I don't know, there's this gut reaction to ISIS and then when I hear Bush and Cheney, I get just furious. And what I'm asking, you're one of the most intelligent radio, TV people that discuss the actual events and, to me, the truth.
Right.
And I want to know if what you're talking about today is from a book or from a magazine, a journal, something.
The things I'm quoting today, you can find all of them boiled down in two really good articles over at commondreams.org, one about Massawi and the other about when George W. Bush decided not to take the Taliban up on their offer of arresting bin Laden. They're both over at commondreams.org. I'm also reading from the New York Times today. There's two pieces from the New York Times, although they don't mention the fact that Bush turned down the offer from the Taliban back in 2001, or early 2002, I guess it was. And that, it was in October of 2001. And that you can find at the Washington Post. It's not today's Washington Post. The article, let me find it here. The article is by Kathy Gannon. It's in the Washington Post, and the headline is Bush Rejects Taliban Bin Laden Offer. Now, Jeremy Scahill wrote a book about all of this, and I haven't read his entire book. I've just skimmed it, and I don't know if he's got the stuff in there about Bush saying no thanks to Bin Laden, but it's a pretty grim book, so you might want to check out Jeremy Scahill's writings as well. Hey, thank you for the call, and thanks for your kind words.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And by the way, did I mention that my new novel, Death in the Pines, which is about a private detective tracking down some nasty GMOs, is now available? Welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. And Jamie in Yelma, Washington. Hey, Jamie, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You wanted to disagree with me?
Well, I watched this film called Loose Change 2, and it just really changed my mind about 9/11.
I've seen it.
You know, have you seen it?
Yeah.
And it just
it did not persuade me.
It persuaded me because the day that night the 12 towers came down, I was sitting in my break room at work, and to me it just looked like an implosion.
Yeah. Well, it was. It was an implosion caused by tens of thousands of gallons of diesel fuel burning in the middle of a building, weakening the center steel structures. I mean, this is fairly well documented in a whole lot of different sources. The idea that somebody had that you know, the guy who owned the buildings, and who is Jewish, by the way, which plays into some of these conspiracy theories. Some of these conspiracy theories are very anti-Semitic. That he was conspiring with Osama bin Laden and or with the CIA or anybody else to hijack two planes and fly them into the buildings after he had had a crew of people go through both buildings and wire them for detonation is, you know, it's crazy, Jamie. It's, you know, people would have noticed. There would have been lots of evidence of the explosives. I mean, lots of evidence of the explosives. It would have been impossible to hide. You could have just caught the signature of it in the air. The building went down.
That's what they said they did, though.
No, they didn't.
They said they tested the dust and everything, and then it was the I can't remember the name of the explosive stuff.
Yeah, C4.
Yeah,
would be what typically what they would use. I do not believe that.
To me it does, because, you know, especially with the Pentagon where it got hit, planes leave wreckage. There was no wreckage
there
at all.
There actually was. They recovered the wheels. They recovered the engines. There was plenty of wreckage.
They never showed them, though. Why didn't they show them?
Oh, there's pictures of it.
I mean, you know, the lawn was still green.
Yeah, it's because the plane hit the side of the building. It didn't hit the lawn.
Uh-huh.
Most of the wreckage was inside the building.
I still have to go with the conspiracy theory. I think it's to me, it was proof.
Well, you know, it's a very well-done movie. It's very well edited. It selectively presents some information and combines it with an enormous amount of speculation, much of which it presents as if it was fact. And, you know, I don't think that we need to go there. You know, it's bad enough as it is. And the role that Bush and Cheney right. played in this thing simply by ignoring the fact that it was coming was, you know, is clearly enough. I mean, to this day, you've got Republicans still trying to indict FDR for Pearl Harbor. Why are they not talking about Bush and Cheney's role in 9/11, or at least in ignoring 9/11 or letting 9/11 happen? You don't need to concoct a government conspiracy or, you know, a Jewish building owner conspiracy to kill thousands of people for what reason? Insurance money or something? You know, that's pretty thin. I think that this thing just stands as it is well enough. Jamie, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before you go. Before the hour, Tom Harbin here with you. Tim, in Chicago, you wanted to make an announcement about the union activity going on in Chicago tonight?
Yes, it's statewide. This is Tim from SEIU, uh-huh. Local 73 in Chicago. And it's Rauner's meeting. Rauner's doing a state of the state tonight. The interesting thing about his speech is that he says unions pay people so well, take care of people so well, their benefits are so good, that we have to do away with collective bargaining and pay people less. I mean, it doesn't make any kind of business sense that our citizens are going to stand for this. And now I'm a Republican that works for SEIU. I mean, I obviously love my brothers and sisters across the aisle. And it's just that, yes, we are all getting together, everyone from AFL-CIO all the way down to me, to get this populace in Illinois to understand that right to work and all these other anti-union facades are nothing more than a business ploy to pay people lower and lower and lower and take away more and more of your benefits.
Yeah.
And Rauner is just one of these Daniels, Kasich, Walker kind of, I don't know. I don't want to say anything negative about him because I don't know the man's soul. I mean,
well, you know his actions, and that's typically enough. What's going on here, Tim, is what Governor Wallace, Vice President Wallace, Henry Wallace, not George Wallace, Henry Wallace, the Vice President of the United States, in April 9, 1944, wrote in the New York Times about the billionaires who were trying to influence American politics. He said they claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but they are the spokesman for monopoly and vested interest. The final objective toward which all of their deceit is directed is to capture political power so that using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the working man in eternal subjection. And that's what this is all about. It's all about power. And that's what Right to Work for Less is all about. It's about power because the only two things that can push back against the power of accumulated capital, whether it's in the form of billionaires like the Koch brothers or whether it's in the form of corporations like Koch Industries, the only thing that can push back against that kind of power is either organized people, which is what government is, or organized people in the workplace, which is what a union is. And so government and unions are the only two things that can balance the power of billionaires and big corporations. And frankly, what the billionaires and big corporations want to do is strip the people of that power by stripping the unions. And then, you know, of course, they get on their high horse and get hysterical about government having that power, too, and start screaming about big government. So, Tim, where and when is the gig tonight in Chicago?
Well, what we're doing is people need to watch the state of the union, the state of the state.
Right.
Call your local union reps I myself am in Chicago. It's pretty easy to find local 73.
Right.
You can call Tim Ball anytime.
Right.
And what we're going to do, the AFL-CIO, all these leaders are getting together tonight. And this is for everybody. This is unions make life better for everybody.
Right.
And it's something I didn't believe at one time. I mean, as a conservative Republican, you know, I had the same kind of silly, goofy party line. Now that I have experienced life, experienced what's going on in the workplace, and seen travesty after travesty, I learned that unions are a right and a privilege that we should not take lightly.
Yeah.
And I'm just reaching across the aisle. Those who are Republicans like myself have got to be in this together with our brothers and sisters who are Democrat and independent.
No, I'm with you. My dad was a Republican until the day he died, and yet he negotiated the union contracts for the guys in the tool and die shop where he worked every year. So I'm totally with you, Tim, and good on you for being a rational Republican. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the heads up. Matt in Springfield, Virginia. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Well, Don, thank you for bringing up that era around 2000, because I think it's instructional to go back and review the zeitgeist that was going on. But I have a little bit more a benign view of actually what happened, because what you started with kind of gets us into truth or terror territory, as you found out. And I don't see the boogeyman that you do in this one.
Which boogeyman is it that I see that you don't see?
Oh, that Cheney, Rumsfeld, Fife, that whole crew was engineered the war with Iraq. I think the war with Iraq, the American people owe a little bit of responsibility for, because after it happened and everyone knew that 17 of the 19 were Saudis, we waited for us to go drop the hammer on the Saudi royal family, you know, and ask them, hey, come on, guys. But instead, we didn't.
No, in fact, we organized airplanes to fly the Saudi royal family out when everything else was locked down. That was what the Bush administration did. They said, we're going to get the bin Laden family out of here.
Yes, but I think that there was a silent acquiescence on the part of the American people that kind of let the Saudis
off. I think the American people were just stunned. They were just stunned. And, you know, Bandar Bush, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, he was like part of the Bush family. He had hung around with them so much, they literally called him Bandar Bush. You had George W. Bush, you know, walking hand in hand with him, holding hands and all this kind of stuff. I think we didn't go after Saudi Arabia because we weren't told the story. And this is what Bob Graham and Bob Kerry are saying. You know, both of them former senators, both of them on the 9/11 commission. They're pointing out that there is a 28-page classified, I believe it's State Department, it might be DOD, summary of Saudi involvement in 9/11. And they want this thing declassified so the American people will know what's going on. Had the American people known what was going on back in 2001, I think, you know, it might not have worked as well for George W. Bush. But he really wanted war with Iraq. His brother lobbied for war with Iraq 2 years before the presidential elections in 98 with the Project for a New American Century. That was Jeb Bush who signed that, and it was Wolfowitz who signed that, and it was the defense of Don Rumsfeld who signed that. And it was Dick Cheney was one of the signatories. I might be wrong on that, but it was, you know, the crew of neocons. They wanted a war with Iraq because they wanted the Iraqi oil. And 9/11 was the perfect excuse to go into Iraq.
Yes, it was an excuse.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think that no one was really convinced of Secretary Powell's speech at the UN. I certainly wasn't. I thought there was no there. And yet,
right.
Iraq was the only target in the Middle East that the United States could safely attack.
Yeah.
Syria was a Russian client state. Saudi Arabia had the oil.
And the fourth and the third largest military in the world, Saudi Arabia has.
We weren't going to do Iran, were we?
No. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. By the way, you know, there's all this Sturm und Drang about the State Department saying, well, actually, it's made its way into television commercials that are running almost nonstop here in Washington, D.C., as the foreign corporation TransCanada and their U.S. buddies are running, you know, just carpet bombing us with ads saying that, you know, Bill Clinton loves this and George W. Bush loves the Keystone XL pipeline and we're not going to export that oil. We're really not. Even though the Democrats proposed an amendment to the authorizing legislation that said that you can't export the oil and the Republicans struck it down. Think about that for a minute. Oh, yeah, we don't want to export this oil. Oh, don't you put that into law, though. So anyhow, the State Department at some point in the past had said, we don't think that this is going to the Keystone XL pipeline is going to significantly increase carbon emissions. And their rationale for that basically was this stuff is not going to come out of the ground. I mean, this stuff is going to come out of the ground no matter what. And whether we refine it here or whether Canada ships it to the East Coast or to the West Coast of Canada, or if they ship it to us by rail car, it's eventually going to come out of the ground. Well, the EPA says, no, you're wrong. And the reason why they say, no, you're wrong is because the price of oil has fallen to the point where this tar sands oil is really just not economical anymore. It's not profitable. And so they're saying, and this just from a letter from the EPA today, they said at sustained oil prices within this range, and they're talking about right now, you know, $40 to $70 roughly, at sustained oil prices within this range, construction of the pipeline is projected to change the economics of oil sands development and result in increased oil sands production and the accompanying greenhouse emissions over what would otherwise occur. This is a letter signed by EPA official Cynthia Giles, or maybe it's Giles, G-I-L-E-S. The State Department has 8 federal agencies, the EPA, the Pentagon, the Department of Energy, the Department of Justice, Department of Interior, Commerce, Transportation, and Homeland Security to weigh in on this. So far, the only agency to publicly release their documents, their thoughts, is the EPA. The Houston Chronicle says, and this, by the way, I'm getting this from an article that's on Common Dreams, written by Deidre Fulton, staff writer over at commondreams.org. The headline is, Final EPA Review Makes It Clear, Keystone a Climate Disaster. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell said Monday that the Interior Department has flagged concerns about tribal consultations and issues raised by Bureau of Reclamation with regard to protecting rural water infrastructure in the pipeline's path. So, you know, we've got treaty obligations. You've got Native Americans who are horrified by this. You've got, you know, what it's going to do to the environment, all this other stuff. Okay, there's that. Have any of you ever dealt with an investment company that won't give you your money? This is just totally bizarre. Last year, Louise had an uncle who is in his late 80s, early 90s, who died. And he was a wonderful guy, Uncle Tom. He's an uncle of Louise's. And he left Louise a couple thousand dollars. I mean, it wasn't big bucks. You know, it was just a few thousand dollars. But he left it in an Edward Jones account. Edward Jones in Oregon then had to send it to Edward Jones here in D.C. And Louise and I went down to Edward Jones and said, give us the money. And they were like, well, you got to fill out this form and you got to fill out that form and you got to do this and that. And so we filled out all the forms and stuff and we still didn't get the money. And then we went back and said, can you give us the money now? And they're like, no, you can't. You know, we can't. There's this problem and that. And it didn't make any sense to me. I couldn't figure it out. So we have some retirement money set aside, and we've got it invested with one of these companies that does that kind of thing. And that you know, you can log on the internet and buy your own stocks and stuff, that kind of thing. Or whatever. And actually, I'm mostly in bonds right now. And so I wanted to get it over there. So I had that company's guy call Edward Jones, and he was able to get about 3/4 of the money away from them. But still, I just got an email again for Edward Jones saying, Franklin Funds has released important addition information to its shareholder. I don't care. I just want the money. What do you do? I mean, we're talking about maybe $5,000 here, but it's like, this is crazy. Is this how it works? I mean, I have never in my life worked with an investment advisor. I've never in my life, gone to one of those places where they tell you, they don't even tell you, they do it for you. You say, here's my money, you invest it. Right? I've never done that. I have, and boy, it's a shocking experience. Or maybe I'm just doing something wrong and I just don't understand how all this stuff works. Anyhow, there's that. We've been talking about Bin Laden, 9/11, brought to you by Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush to a large extent as well. And all the neocons who wanted to reshape the Middle East. Meanwhile, there's two kinds of voter suppression going on in the United States big time right now. And one, I think, is the worst, and nobody ever talks about it. And the second is the most visible, and it's having a relatively small effect, but it's real. And that's the one that everybody knows about, which is the voter ID laws. Don Yelton was the precinct chair for the Buncombe County, North Carolina Republican Party. And then John Stewart sent somebody down to interview him for The Daily Show. And the guy comes out and says that the ID law in North Carolina, the law is going to kick the Democrats in the butt. He says, no, it's not a racist law at all. He said, but if it hurts a bunch of college kids that's too lazy to get off their bahunkus and get a photo ID, so be it. And if it hurts a bunch of lazy blacks that want the government to give them everything, so be it. This is the head of the Republican Party in this county, or the precinct chair in Buncombe County. He has now resigned. Why? Because the Republicans were unhappy that he told an inconvenient truth. But the kind of voter suppression that is less visible, that I think is truly horrific, is the one that says it's a two-step process. Number one, let's pass laws saying that if you're a felon at any time in your life, if you committed a felony, you can never vote ever again. And then number two, let's start aggressively, quote, enforcing the law in communities of color. So a black person in Florida, for example, is 8 times more likely to be arrested for smoking pot than a white person, even though as a percentage of the population, more white people smoke pot than black people. If you're white, you're more likely to smoke pot than if you're black. But blacks get arrested 8 times more frequently, and they get that felony on their record, and then they can't vote. There are 600,000 African Americans in Florida, 400,000 in North Carolina, and God only knows in the other states what the numbers are. And I'm sure the numbers are out there. These are just the ones I know off the top of my head. African Americans who have felonies on their records and therefore cannot vote. Can you imagine if tomorrow 600,000 African Americans in Florida, 400,000 African Americans in North Carolina suddenly were able to vote? Those states would not be red states any longer. And I think the same is true. I don't have the statistics to back it up, but I believe that the same would probably be true of Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Texas, all of these southern states. What we are seeing is a white power structure hanging on, in large part because they pass laws that say that people who have felonies can't vote, and then they have followed policies for generations that overrepresent African Americans in the felon population. Anyhow, more on that and 9/11 and everything else right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So Massawi is now saying that Saudi princes, including the one who owns a piece of Fox News, helped finance 9/11. You think you're going to hear about this on 9/11? Excuse me, on Fox News? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Victor in Grass Valley, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Victor, what's on your mind?
Well, a couple facts about 9/11. I don't know if you know Michael Rodriguez. He was the janitor in the buildings that saved over 100 lives that day. He had the fight to get recognition for the 2,200 undocumented workers in the building and get them money. So The real number is like 52, not 3,000.
That's interesting.
So that's one fact. I don't know if you've seen The Real Matrix. I suggest you watch that and then give us an opinion about 9/11 again.
Yeah.
Because
this is another 9/11 truther
so
movie.
Obvious. Huh?
This is another 9/11 truther movie.
Yes. And it's the best one I've seen so far. Okay. I mean, the Pentagon buildings is so obvious. There's no plane. There's no plane. And for the FBI to get all the video footage from all around there in 45 minutes, so there could be nothing, and then the only footage they show is a flash.
Well, where did that plane go? Where are those people who are on that plane?
Close Air Force Base.
So Ted Olson's wife was on that plane. She was, you know, Ted Olson is the guy who argued gay marriage before the Supreme Court. He was the guy who helped George W. Bush become president through the Supreme Court. He was a solicitor general in the Reagan administration, I believe. Where is his wife?
They killed them all. There's for their goal is to do what they've done, is to put this chaos. And
so you think that our government hijacked a commercial plane, flew it to a military base, and that our enlisted soldiers murdered the people on the plane? You really expect me to believe that?
I do believe that. I do believe they've done something with them, whether they're dead or not. Nobody knows.
Why?
Real investigation.
Why would they do that?
Because they look at the mindset of the people. I've been talking 9/11 truth since the day it was obvious. That I looked at it and going, this can't happen. All these things where they don't intercept the jets cannot happen like this. The buildings cannot fall down like that. It's impossible. Architects and engineers put out a video about that. The 9/11, the pilots put out a video about they can't fly a plane around the Pentagon like that into the place where they reconstructed 75 million.
Well, you can't fly a drone over the White House and land it on the White House lawn, but they did day before yesterday. Or last Friday,
yeah.
I guess it
was. So they...
I mean, just because something in theory isn't supposed to be able to happen and does, doesn't make it a conspiracy.
No, but facts should be the truth of all matter. So if you're not looking at the facts... Michael Rodriguez, the first person he saved that day was in the cellar, in the basement of the buildings. An explosive went off before the planes even hit the buildings. And this guy had third-degree burns. That was the first person he saved that day. He was a janitor, and there was only five people had the key to the floors, like 115th floor. The doors are closed for, you know, fire break. He's the only one that had the keys. He had to go up there and help the firemen.
So you think somebody wired the building with explosives, too, the buildings, both buildings?
I met Michael Rodriguez personally, and yes.
Who did that?
There was all kinds of things. It was Marvin Bush. As the head of the security...
No, Marvin Bush hadn't been involved in the security at the World Trade Center for over a year.
Well, we cannot save this country without the truth of 9/11, because you're not going to get the Republicans to face what is going on, the lies.
Victor, thank you for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Amir in Algonquin, Illinois. Hey, Amir. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Yes. How you doing? First, it's a privilege to talk to you. I watch you as much as I can.
Well, thank you.
As much as I can. We need some program like yours and the other Free Speech TV more and more and more.
Thank you.
Anyway. The point I want to make is none of these things happen if we had a real good foreign policy. All these things happen after 40s or whatever it was, when the Arabs and all Middle East opened their arms for, especially for Americans, and go over there. But we just holding on the old foreign policy. We don't respect them, and they don't come and respect. They don't respect us. Simple as that. If it's that, we're gonna lose because they are not dumb people. They 9/11 happened. All of them, they were educated. They were mostly in Western. They had PhD and all those kind of things, and they know what they are doing. None of these. And when we go, and you said Cheney and all those people, they go and torture the other people in Iraq and in other places, and they are proud of it. Then we don't have right to say, okay, the other people, they do not, they shouldn't torture. They do, right. They shouldn't do that.
Well, yeah, here's something to Amir, thank you. Very well said. Thank you for the call and your comments. Here's something to ponder. We look at ISIS beheading, I guess they're up to maybe a dozen high-profile people now, and burning this Jordanian pilot to death while he's still alive. And we say, correctly, this is hideous and barbaric. And these are our friends and some of our people, some American citizens, who are being slaughtered by these ISIS guys. Most of ISIS, most of its command structure, are former Iraqi officers or former Iraqi warlords, you know, guys, Sunnis, basically, who were sick and tired of our having supported a Shiite government in Iraq that was suppressing the Sunnis. And in the process of doing that, in the process of our bombing Iraq and drone strikes and everything else, a lot of these people have had members of their families killed, bombed, incinerated, blown to smithereens, shot up by American forces, American planes, American bombs. They have seen a mind-boggling amount of brutality. We have killed hundreds of thousands of people in that region. So from their point of view, we are the brutal ones. And I'm telling you, this is a great example of what it says in which book of the Bible is it? Where this stuff is laid out. It's in the Old Testament. It's not Song of Songs. Anyhow, maybe it's Psalms, but sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. The whirlwind. We are reaping the whirlwind of our own actions in that part of the world. And it's time for us to back away. I mean, we have to dial back the military and amp up the Marshall Plan reconstruction. Keep in mind, Afghanistan is a country with a $2 billion a year GDP if you take out all the military stuff. And there functionally was no military stuff before we got there. So for a fraction of what we're spending fighting these people, we could be rebuilding their country and bringing them in the modern age. But no, that doesn't produce money for our military contractors, for the defense contractors who own so many politicians in this town and who live in the 30-bedroom mansions that ring Washington, D.C. I don't know what was in George W. Bush's mind when he rejected the Taliban's offer to arrest bin Laden and turn him over to the IOC, to basically a group of Arab countries who would almost certainly put him to death. The entire world and the entire Arab world was horrified by 9/11, or virtually the entire Arab world was horrified. I mean, there was a candlelight vigil in downtown Tehran, Iran. George W. Bush wanted to have a war. He believed, and he told his biographer this, Mickey Herskowitz, he believed that if he had, that his father had wasted the political capital that he got invading Kuwait and throwing the Iraqis out of Kuwait, because his father's war only lasted 3 days, the Gulf War I. George W. Bush felt that his father had squandered his own political capital by having that war only last 3 days, having a 100-hour war. Maybe that's 4 days. And he was going to have a war that lasted at least until the next election. He ended up having two of them, Afghanistan and Iraq. And sure enough, it arguably got him reelected. I mean, if you can kind of set aside the shenanigans in Ohio and Ken Blackwell and, you know, the Ohio vote being counted on the servers, Dick Cheney's servers over in Kentucky or Tennessee and all that. You know, I mean, all this weird stuff that happened in 2004. If you can, you know, if you can overlook that or set that aside, I mean, it's George Bush's strategy, George W. Bush's strategy worked to get himself reelected. It also worked to destroy America. It worked to destroy the Middle East. It worked to create generations of people who hate us. It worked to create a policy that Obama inherited and has tried to dial back, but now is being pushed really aggressively to dial back up again, which very, very much concerns me, and I think it concerns many of them. So let's at least acknowledge the crimes that were committed in our name by our elected officials. Let's issue a pardon, a formal pardon, to George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and crew, so that their crimes are on the record.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Before you can issue a pardon, you have to list the person's crimes. This is something that the administration should be able to do. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Why is it that they never mention when they talk about, you know, the pilot being caught on fire, that all of this is the consequence of the United States invading Afghanistan and Iraq under George W. Bush? Or that, you know, when they talk about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, why don't they mention the fact that he was brought to prominence by Ronald Reagan? Reagan brought bin Laden's buddies in the Mujahideen to the White House and called them freedom fighters, gave them $5 billion. We created Al-Qaeda. We put this thing together, the Mujahideen. We funded it, Charlie Wilson's war. And then we sit around going, gee, I can't figure out why they're upset with us. Why are they killing? Why are they beheading people? Isn't that brutal? Well, you know, the country that they arguably see as their spiritual lodestone, Saudi Arabia, beheads people every week, it seems. Let's say regularly. And the ones they don't behead, they cut their hands off or they flog them. This is our great ally in the region. That's amazing. Okay, what's this here? Oh. Bobby Rivers tweeting, Tom Hartman, it's too late to investigate 9/11. You and Ed Schultz said free health was more important to invest in than justice. Let me get this straight. Because I supported Obamacare, I'll take Ed out of the equation. I can't speak for Ed. Because I supported Obamacare in 2009, somehow magically that changes the investigations in 2002, 2003, 2004. I don't get that one. Color me confused. Oops, hang on just a minute here. Let's see, there were a few others. Oh, Desert Storm lasted 48 hours of actual combat. I was there, says Gene Starwind. Okay, Gene, if you were there and it was 48 days, I defer to your opinion. I remember George W. Bush bragging about a 100-hour war. I'll have to look that up and get the details. I was just running off the top of my head. And then Anthony points out part of that amendment was to use steel made in the United States from a proud Teamster, he says. You're right. And the State of the State address in Illinois is starting right now. This is just from looking at our Twitter feed. So anyhow, back to your thoughts on all this. Sean in Chicago. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I think the number one thing too that's going on, that is the cancer of having hegemony over the rest of the planet. I mean, as long as the U.S. government had this mentality, it's going to be wars. And a lot of people, and Tom too, a lot of people don't realize that what allowed this cancer to spread with this hegemony thing was the collapse of the Soviet Union, because Russia and the United States pretty much held each other in check, you know. And another thing, you know, as long as once you effectively demonize people, you will be allowed to kill them indiscriminately. So long as Africans and long as there's Muslims are the ones that's being bombed, then there's really going to be no pushback from the Western countries. It may be a little in groups, but the fact that that's why we get to see, you know, the burning and the beheadings, but we don't never see the Tomahawk missiles and the drone killings. We don't never see that. Right. We can magically always see what these guys in karate suits is doing to people. And right. Just like you said, Tom, you know, bombing these people for the last 14, 15 years, you think there's not going to be a generation of people pissed off?
Yeah.
And what's sad too, Tom, is Americans in these Western countries, just like what happened in Paris, you know, but your same government was the same government that was bombing these people indiscriminately.
Yeah.
Just like Americans.
Yeah, if for France, it's Algeria, you know, the Algerian colonialism comes home. We were fine bombing Vietnamese as long as they were not, you know, white Europeans, basically. I mean, you're absolutely right, Sean, and we need to wake up and move beyond this. I mean, the metaphor that I always use, and I think it's something Americans really need to consider, is, you know, a lot of Americans, in fact, I would say probably the majority of Americans, George W. Bush's approval ratings were in the low 30s when he left office. So the majority of Americans were horrified by George W. Bush and his stupid wars. So what if the, you know, Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, decided in the last years of the George W. Bush administration that George W. Bush had become a tyrannical force in the United States. He had lied America into a war. He was committing other high crimes and misdemeanors. He failed to stop 9/11, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so Stephen Harper says, I'll do a favor to the United States. We're going to send the Canadian army down there and some Canadian planes. We're going to bomb Washington, D.C. and New York City. We're going to get all of the Republicans out of power, just the same way we did in Iraq, where we took out the Ba'athist Party. We're going to take out the Republican Party. We're going to arrest these leaders and hold them for trial. I'm telling you, the minute that the Canadian troops came into the United States, Democrats would be grabbing guns to shoot back, in defense of George W. Bush, because he's our president. You don't mess with a country. You don't go in and kill their people. You don't capture their politicians and not expect them, particularly once you start occupying them. I mean, if Canada then occupied the United States for the next 15 years, all hell would break loose here.
Exactly. And one more thing. Now, look at the lives that in Libya when Gaddafi was in power, in Iraq when Saddam was in power. Was the people better off with them or afterwards? You know, it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm with you. Sean, thank you for the call. Well said. Bonnie in Middletown, New Jersey. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Tom. I want to start off with my daughter. For 2 years of her young life was a financial advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll sit down and have a powwow. If she has any information that might help, then in the words of the very eloquent Sarah Palin, I'll get back to ya.
Okay. Well, I see that I've got a call from a fellow in Tennessee who says he's got information on how Louise can get her money from Edward Jones. So
okay.
we'll find out.
Cool,
but you wanted to talk about your husband?
Yeah. Well, personal experience of the events of 9/11. And I wanted to share it with the truthers out there. I know sometimes trauma affects everyone differently, and a lot of people just have a whole lot of trouble accepting the truth. But I was on the phone that morning and my husband is very predictable, saying, you know, get that call same time. And while we were on the phone, I heard the explosion. He told me that, well, the people in his office, he was working on Rector Street, which is two blocks away from Trade Center, and they saw something fall from the roof of their building. Mm. So with the visual of seeing something fall from the building at the same time hearing that explosion, they thought it was an incendiary device that fell from the roof of the building.
Right.
I heard it. He said, I've got to go, and told me there was a bomb. And I had the news on muted. And when I hung up, I was watching the second plane hit the second tower.
Right.
Now, that wheel was retrieved. It was a wheel that, from the first plane, that had hit the roof, bounced, and fell to the ground that they saw, and it was retrieved.
Wow.
Okay. So the physical evidence is there. They can continue believing in whatever fantasy they want, but that was the truth. And my husband was one of the very fortunate that did come home that day. We lost 40 people that we knew that day.
Wow.
He drove to work with a group of guys. It was one of those big vans with a living room on wheels with the Barca lounge in it.
Right.
Every day for years, and they all worked for Cantor Fitzgerald.
Oh, which got totally wiped out at the.
And he lost. Yeah. One of the guys wasn't there because his mother died the day before, and he was making funeral arrangements. Wow. And that was the only reason, you know, he's with us, and he's yet to get over that horrible guilt feeling, you know, the guilt of a survivor.
Survivor's guilt, yeah. That's tough.
You know, everybody, you know, it's a sad story. Anyone who lived in the tri-state area can tell you at least a few. But to hear these people, I mean, go on with these horrible, just wasting their time and their effort and their energy. I mean, when Henry came home stinking of death, I said to him then and there, and it proved me true, that we'll see the best of humanity and we will see the worst of humanity because of this tragedy. And that's exactly how it played out, Tom.
Yeah. And we had an opportunity. Had we had a different president, we would have had an opportunity to see the best of humanity and the best of humanity.
Yeah.
In my opinion. I mean, it's the way that the Maggie Thatcher, as much as I dislike Maggie Thatcher, the way she dealt with the Irish Republican Army, who tried to kill her. They blew up the building next door to number 10 Downing Street. They nearly killed her. The way that she dealt with them was, these people are criminals, and we will track them down, and we will prosecute them. Not, we're going to declare a war on terror, and we're going to, you know, start spying on everybody. No, that took Tony Blair. Bonnie, thank you for the call and for your very, very insightful and trenchant observations and commentary. Appreciate it. We'll be back. It is 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your thoughts, my thoughts, the news of the day, and we'll be checking in with the Talk Radio News Service in a few minutes. And welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. David in Brentwood, Tennessee, watching us at TomHartman.com. Hey, David.
Hello, good morning.
Says here, you know how we can get our money back from Edward Jones.
Well, I told the screen, I missed the first part of that, so I don't know the exact answer.
Louise's uncle died. And he had an account with Edward Jones, and in his will or whatever, you know, when it was disposed of his assets, a couple thousand bucks was left to Louise. And we extracted some of it from Edward Jones, but they still are sitting on several thousand of it, and we can't figure out how to get it away from them. We keep showing up and saying we want the money, and they keep saying we can't give it to you.
Jones itself may not have anything to do with that. I mean, it's not something that Edward Jones would have made that investment.
Right.
So sometimes you have estate things where they may need some type of state document allowing the release, or in some cases, if it's, say it's a bond, it may have a redemption feature that is on the clock of the issuer.
No, it's not. I checked on that. These are funds.
Yeah.
These are mutual funds.
Mutual funds generally would be fairly liquid, but there's always, you know, like each state could have requirements that let's say, you know, they'll, her grandfather, you know, they may hold it in freeze it until they can make sure that he doesn't have any outstanding debt.
No, that's all been resolved. He's been totally probated. There's no unresolved part of that. This does not have to do with it being an inheritance. That's what baffles me. I thought I was a smart guy and I knew this stuff. And they're like, well, you've got to fill out this form, then you got to fill out this form, and then no, we can't give you the money. And finally, they gave us the majority of the money when the guy from the other company that I keep, you know, our retirement funds with, called him up and said, transfer it to me. And they just transferred it. This is after I showed up personally twice saying, give me the money. And they said no. And, you know,
overall, it is a wonderful firm. I mean, now I can't say that there's not, may not be a bad apple there somewhere. I don't know. But
right.
The other thing I really wanted to point out is you may be in, and I've read your book. I'm a big fan, Crash, you know, 26, but, if you're overweight bonds, you might not be doing yourself any favors.
Because?
I mean, because a bond is a loan, right? So, you know, it's either a government loan or a loan to a corporation.
I'm entirely in treasuries.
Well, but if you're doing short-term treasury,
actually, I'm doing treasury ETFs. I'm doing TLT and the like.
Okay.
UBT.
So if you are in short-term treasuries, there's no yield.
Right.
So you're basically just parking in almost like a cash equivalent because it's not much. Return.
Essentially, except that they've gone up substantially. I mean, I'm actually, for the first time in my life, I'm making money without working. It's astonishing.
Some of it is changes in interest rates, which can go the other way.
Right, I know that.
Because a lot of treasuries are long-term.
Right.
You know, and so if you take a 20-year treasury.
TLT is a 20-year ETF, 20-year treasury ETF.
20-year treasury, as of yesterday, was yielding about 2.16.
Right.
Right? So behind that ETF are 20-year treasury bonds.
Right.
Right? So if you just had one bond, that's one loan for 20 years to the treasury.
Right.
And it's getting 2.16. If rates go up, if in a year from now you're obligated for 20 years, you could get that same loan, and it would pay 4%.
Right, I understand.
No one's going to want your bond, so the value can drop.
Right, no, I understand. As much profit as I've made investing in TLT and the like, if the stock market goes up and the bond market goes down and interest rates go up, then, you know, it's like basically people are investing in equities or bonds. Right now they're investing in both. But bonds seem to be the safe haven. But I, you know, I understand all that, David. What I don't understand is how to get my money from Edward Jones. But thank you for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can help a returning slave in South Sudan, and free-don.org, where you can keep up on the status of America's political prisoner, Don Siegelman. Ellen Ratner with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you. I just want to add one thing. There's still time to get the Swarovski crystal hearts made by women who have seen somebody killed in front of them in South Sudan through Valentine's Day, and I'm holding one up here.
Oh, marvelous. And that's through goatsfortheoldgoat.com,
right.
Which is you being the old goat, this is your little charity. And
that's
it's
and you have those
one.
Nice Swarovski crystal hearts made by our women, and we bring the crystals over, and they make them.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Ashton Carter today, he had his confirmation hearing, and of course now John McCain runs that committee, and this is confirming him as defense secretary. He said that he basically, this is Ashton Carter, he believes that sequestration, which in other words means not more money for defense, is actually introduces uncertainty, and he believes it's risky to our defense. In other words, more money for the Pentagon. He also said that taxpayers cannot support these cost overruns. So then Senator McCain gets there, and he said, he quoted that's just the briefing. I can't shut that off there. I'm at the White House.
That's okay. We can hardly hear it.
Okay. So Senator John McCain then said that he quoted two previous defense secretaries, including Leon Panetta, and he said the White House tries to micromanage the Department of Defense. He said also that individuals were not held responsible for cost overruns and overspending. Also, Ashton Carter said that he would cut through the red tape in terms of hurrying arms sales to Jordan. Now, of course, this is a big issue given what has gone on with the killing of the brutal killing of that pilot who was flying an F-16 that went down in Syria.
Right. So, is this? I mean, does Jordan need more weaponry? They've got a pretty pretty strong military.
You and I would not think they necessarily need more weaponry, but, you know, this is a game of who's got the most toys.
Well, Saudi Arabia has the third largest military in the world. When are they going to get involved?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, obviously, there's now, of course, some rumors that there is this report that former Senator Graham of Florida is said that they're sitting on, which ties some of the Saudis to supporting Osama bin Laden's people in 9/11, and they're trying to get their hold on that still classified report.
Right. Yeah. So it's amazing.
Kind of interesting. President today met with six dreamers. These are people who were came to the United States before 2007, came before they were 16, grew up as Americans, and of course, the president's legislation has made them able to get work permits, etc. There are now 581,000 individuals as of June 2014 that have been part of this. It is the president said that he will veto any action that takes these people back home or deports them or doesn't allow them to work. And he said young people didn't think it was possible for themselves to go to college or suddenly able to go to college. He talked about executive actions. And he said these dream kids are now, because of this, able to go to college. And he also wants, he basically extended this eligibility with his written executive order. Okay, South Sudan. This is a little bit of yesterday's news, but I think it's relevant, as I will be in South Sudan 2 weeks from today. And Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he warned yesterday, late afternoon, that the leaders have got to put their interests, the country's interests and the people's interests, above their own. And he also said that they did not agree on a power-sharing agreement, and he wants them to do that. It is hurting the country. He was very, very vocal about this.
Do I have this right that the them that you're talking about is Salva Kiir, the president, and I forget the name of the vice president?
He was the vice president. Salva Kiir kicked him out, and now he's running the rebel group.
Bachar?
Machar.
Okay. And so basically,
he's also responsible for supposedly the murder of 2,000 Dinkas, which of course is Salva Kiir's tribe, in the year 2000 or right around then.
Right. So this has become a tribal war and a civil war in South Sudan.
Exactly.
So how do you see this playing out? Do you think the South Sudan will get split in half between the Dinkas and whatever Machar's tribe is?
Well, that's a lot more complicated because of where the oil is in Bor. There's supposed to be elections in May or June of this year. If that really happens, if they're really free and open and fair, there's a lot going on. Is it a proxy war that's going on between North Sudan and Museveni, I guess that's how you pronounce it, Uganda, that borders South Sudan. I mean, it is a mess. But, you know, I'll be talking about that when I call in. Okay.
Travel safely.
Thank you. Well, vaccine naysayers have been donors to Ready for Hillary. This is a group that has Albert Dowskin and his wife Claire. They've had President Clinton speak at their house. They have a family foundation that has tied vaccines to autism. They also have this Children's Medical Safety Research Institute that they've donated for. He's donated more than $10,000 to Ready for Hillary. So now the vaccine discussion comes on both sides of the fence here.
Okay.
Now, this is my last but not least, but it's long, so tell me if we're going to run out of time.
We have a little less than a minute.
Okay. So basically, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler wrote an op-ed today on his proposal to protect net neutrality, but this is very interesting. He wants to reclassify the Internet as a utility. It looks like he has a 3-2 vote because it has to be supported by a vote. This is under Title II, and if he does that, then it doesn't matter whether your Internet is given to you, if you get it on a hard line, if you get it mobile wirelessly, it will still be the same way. And these are his rules. No blocking. You can't block access to the Internet, legal content to the Internet. or services, no throttling, meaning that you cannot impair or degrade the information, in other words, make it slow, no paid prioritization, which means something like Netflix, et cetera, cannot pay more to one of these companies to get their content.
So Comcast is going to have to give Netflix a million-dollar rebate, a refund or something.
Exactly.
Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
It's great to see you. It's always great to see you. We'll be right back. It's coming up on the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Lori Wallach is on the line with us, the Executive Director of Global Trade Watch, author of The Rise and Fall of Fast Track Trade Authority, the website citizen.org/trade. Lori, welcome back to the program.
Hello.
Hi. Great to have you with us. What is the current status of this whole Fast Track TPP, the treaty that I call the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA? What's going on with this?
Well, unfortunately, the Obama administration is very keen to wrap it up in the next couple of months. The top trade negotiator testified to Congress last week that he hoped by the end of March he'd be able to announce a final deal, which would wrap up 5 years of closed-door negotiations with basically 500 corporate official U.S. trade advisors and Congress and the public out on 29 chapters over 1,000 pages of agreement that would rewrite wide swaths of our domestic laws and make it easier for big corporations to offshore our jobs to countries like Vietnam, with its 58 cents an hour wages, so that actually, as well as losing jobs, we'll see downward pressure on wages throughout our economy.
Do I have it right?
The antithesis of middle class economics.
Yeah. Lori, do I have it right? We're talking with Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch, citizen.org/trade. Do I have it right that if this treaty passes, one of the possible side effects will be massive deregulation of industry and banking in the United States, because no longer will they have to comply with the United States standards, but that individual transnational corporations can sue us as a country for passing laws or rules that might diminish the profitability of companies that want to pollute and things like that?
Yes, actually. This agreement, we know of all the things that are secret that we don't know about it, we know it includes the same foreign investor privileges that were in NAFTA, only much broader version of them. These are the rules that both incentivize offshoring of our jobs to lower-wage countries, because the rules basically give all kinds of new privileges if you leave, ways to get compensation from the government you relocate to for just having to follow basic regulatory standards. And it gets you out of having to ever use a domestic court system, because there's special corporate tribunals where these foreign investors can have their case heard. And by the way, that's a boomerang effect that could be done to us as well.
Right.
But also, those tribunals, separate from those tribunals' existence prioritizing leaving so you get the benefit of that, those tribunals also mean that our U.S. laws could be attacked by foreign investors from the other TPP countries. And in a closed-door tribunal staffed by three private sector attorneys who rotate between suing governments for corporations and being the judges, we could be ordered to pay out of the U.S. Treasury billions of dollars in compensation. There is no outside appeal, and there is no limit on the amount that can be paid out. That system is called investor-state dispute resolution. Folks should just think about basically as like a corporate tribunal where your treasury gets raided, your future gets trashed, and all your domestic laws can get attacked. Right. That's at the heart of TPP, and we know that. So that would be enough to make us all want to make sure that our members of Congress do not support fast track. That's this crazy Nixon era procedure that President Obama is now saying he wants to railroad the TPP through Congress. TPP has enough stuff to aggravate, irritate, and upset about half plus of the Congress, which is to say it cannot get through Congress in the sunshine and openness of normal procedure. Right. So this process, fast track, is like some kind of legislative luge run that just by sheer force of the process can ram an agreement like TPP through Congress, even though it would never get through there were it to be actually debated fully.
That's amazing. Laurie, back in April of 1944, the New York Times asked then Vice President Henry Wallace, FDR's vice president, his third term, asked him to comment on the behavior of the American billionaire class, as it were. And in his op-ed in the New York Times, Vice President Wallace wrote, "They claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but they are the spokesman for monopoly and vested interest. Their final objective, toward which all their deceit is directed, is to capture political power so that, using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the working man in eternal subjection." Now, he was envisioning and complaining about and concerned about a time that I think we could say is probably here as a result of Citizens United, when billionaires could seize control of the political process and use the rulemaking ability of the political process to promulgate rules that are beneficial to the billionaires. Doesn't TPP take us a whole universe of a step out of that or beyond that, where we're not even saying the billionaires get to own the politicians who make the rules? We're saying the politicians no longer can make the rules. The rules are being made by transnational corporations.
That's more or less the import of the TPP. It would require us to conform all of our domestic laws, regulations, and administrative procedures to the non-trade rules in this expansive 29-chapter pact. And then if we don't, either a direct corporation can sue us in one of these tribunals and demand taxpayer compensation, the investor-state system, right, or a government can sue us and say, hey, you have to change that banking law. Our government's fighting your government. You signed this treaty, and if you don't, until you do, we're going to hit you up with trade sanctions. Right. That basically is like a barrier to our trade. It's like an extra tax that's supposed to pressure us economically, right, to roll back our laws. And the bottom line of that is, instead of making our policies here and changing them if they don't work out, we would be super gluing into place this one version of special corporate privileges and limits on regulation, and you can't change a comma unless every single country involved, and there are 12 of them in this TPP, all agree. It's consensus. Right. So, for instance, there's language in there that would basically require us to import food from Malaysia and Vietnam, shrimp. They both send a lot of shrimp that just don't meet our standards. Under current law, a bunch of the stuff gets sent back. I mean, you know, unfortunately, a bunch of the stuff is being farmed, the shrimp, in ponds of
toxic
waste,
fertilized basically
by ponds of human waste.
Yeah.
And there are antibiotics thrown in there we ban. And under these kind of rules, even though Congress says, that's not, you can't sell that here.
Right. Amazing.
You would basically make it a trade challenge if you stuck to our rules. Right.
Lori, just a minute left. How do you respond to the administration's talking point that this is a way of cutting China, you know, down to size a little bit, that we're making deals? This is a deal with everybody but China, and that will work to our benefit because China's eaten our lunch so badly.
Well, it's ridiculous because at the same time they're saying that, they've spent the last 3 years trying to get China to join the TPP. China has indicated it will join the TPP, and the administration has said, great, we want China to join the TPP, number one. Number two, those kind of sort of foreign policy arguments are always what gets raised with no merit because none of what they say have said for similar agreements in the past comes true, but it's what gets raised when they run out of economic arguments. And the data is compelling. These kind of trade agreements cost good jobs, push down our wages, and the public doesn't want them. So now they're trying to scare us with the boogeyman of China. Right. You know something? In past PACs, they've said over and over, the Central America PAC, CAFTA, if we don't do this, China's going to take over market share.
Right.
Central America's going to become instable and have immigration waves.
And it hasn't happened. Lori, we're out of time, but thank you so much. Lori Wallach, citizen.org/trade. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Great talking to you, as always.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lori's website, citizen.org/trade. Check it out. We'll be back. Welcome back. Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind, my friend?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Haven't read Death in the Pines yet, but I think Dead Reckoning is a great title for a book. But
Dead Reckoning, that was what's his name's book? Point-to-point Navigation.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Maybe you discussed it, but
back to you.
I'm wondering your thoughts on tying together the ISIS burning of the Jordanian pilot with early American history. Did early white Americans actually burn midwives, which men called witches, so that men could keep control over women's bodies and secure that men would be the doctors?
You're right.
What do you think?
No, you're right. Although I don't think there was the burning of women happened in Europe. In the United States, it was mostly hanging and drownings.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So really, they didn't burn witches at the
In Massachusetts, I had said this in an article I wrote, or maybe it was even in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. This was back 20 years ago, and somebody corrected me on that and said, here's some historical sources, and I went back and looked, and it was all in Massachusetts. And they were not burning women to death. There was one case of a woman who was stoned, a couple who were hung, and a couple who were tossed into the water. And if they drowned, that meant that they weren't a witch. And if they floated, that meant they were a witch. And so they drowned.
All right. So how do you tie that together with ISIS's burning of a Jordanian pilot?
Well, our barbarism from 200 years ago or more, I don't tie it together. What I tie together is that all over the Middle East, there are people who have seen family members killed as a consequence of American involvement in their country. And they're angry. And I think with some justification, nobody likes their country to be occupied. And particularly when the basis for the occupation, our occupation of both Iraq and Afghanistan, was bogus. The Taliban in Afghanistan offered to arrest bin Laden and give him to a third party for prosecution, and they were quite serious about that. And George W. Bush said, no, I want to have a war. And Iraq never did anything. I mean, they didn't even have weapons of mass destruction, as Hans Blix was aggressively telling the entire planet. And George W. Bush was just, aggressively ignoring that because he wanted to have a good war that would get him reelected in 2004.
Gotcha. One last question. Are 22 veterans a day committing suicide within the United States?
To the best of my knowledge, that number sounds, it seems to comport with the stuff I've read. I don't know for a fact, but.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah. You're welcome, Michael. Thank you for the call. And say that again. Yeah. True Blood. What is True Blood? Oh, okay. Dead Reckoning is taken, Shane says, but you can't copyright a book title. No, I wrote a book called Healing ADD, and another guy, Dan Amen, wrote a book called Healing ADD and basically just, copied my title a year later. Book was doing really well, and so, hey, let's rip off this title. Maybe, or maybe it was just a coincidence that Dan had a brilliant idea at the same time I did, or a year afterwards. But the net is you can't copyright a book title. I learned that the hard way. Anyhow, we'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. But Point to Point Reckoning was Gore Vidal's final autobiography, and the last two chapters of it are about me and Lamar and our JFK research. So, anyhow, we'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Stick around. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Yes, John Donne. That was E. Cummings. No, that was Wordsworth. Oh, well, I'm mixing up my poets. As is my wont. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to tell you why I think the XL pipeline is such a bad investment for America. The linchpin to the pipeline is a place called Cushing, Oklahoma, and Cushing is one of the largest oil storage depots in the world. It's an endless horizon of oil storage tanks, pipes, and pumps, and the bitumen, or the oil, is going to be piped down from the Canadian tar sands and stored at Cushing, where it's mixed with a lighter crude and then shipped all the rest of the way down to – it's piped all the rest of the way down to the Texas coast. But the problem with Cushing is that it's in Tornado Alley. And on May 31st, 2013, the largest tornado ever recorded, the El Reno, E-L-R-E-N-O, tornado, the El Reno tornado, was heading toward Cushing. It was 2.6 miles wide, and it was close to 300 miles an hour. And
whoa.
It was moving toward Cushing, and it just veered off at the last minute. And it turns out that a tornado a week earlier threw a 10-ton water tank over a school, half a mile, and it was called the Moore Tornado. And so here we have, as the climate heats up, you're going to get more and more moisture in the air, which gives rise to even bigger tornadoes and hurricanes and typhoons. So and there's another problem. If that isn't bad enough, there's another problem. It's Oklahoma in 2009 experienced 50 earthquakes, but with fracking and toxic waste disposal in 2010, there were over 1,000 earthquakes. And Cushing, there's a major fault that passes underneath Cushing. So from above, the disasters from a tornado and an earthquake, I think, make Cushing one of the most vulnerable spots in the planet for a...
Right.
A
is Cushing by any chance, Harvey, over the Ogallala Aquifer, or is that farther to the east?
I believe it's farther to the east. It's more, yeah. But if you look at Cushing and put in El Reno tornado and read about it and get scared, I did. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I think that's it for the XL pipeline. I mean, that's.
We'll see.
It.
I mean, never underestimate the power of billionaire corporations and billionaire investors. But you know, hopefully you're right. Harvey, thank you for the call. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Oh, hi. I was just going to say, somebody talked about the Twin Towers again, and the Society of Structural Engineers looked at the building and why it fell down. And it was because it really was a very unusual design at the time it was built. Didn't have a core like a typical building, and all of the stresses for the wind, et cetera, were on the outside. So when that was breached, and the fire happened, and the very weak structure of all the floors started to pile up on one another as a couple of them fell because of the fire. Right. That's why it fell down. So
I've read the analysis, and I believe it to be the case. The idea that the guy who owned the buildings or the CIA or anybody else hired a crew to put C4 on every floor of both buildings and somehow was able to detonate it. And that they coordinated with Bin Laden or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or whatever to hijack American planes, and it's too much,
Yeah,
Occam's razor, please.
Hello. Yeah, unless the Society of Structural Engineers is some sort of secret organization, which
yeah.
they're not.
No, they're not.
You know, the other thing was is that, you know, as I was listening, the reason I originally called is, remember back in the 60s in the anti-war movement and the teach-ins, you know, and with every topic from TPP, which is really, really an amazing thing, you think the right wing and their noise machine would be all over this because it is so inimical to their, you know, their hatred of the UN, having other countries, you know, our soldiers under some guy from Holland. You know, I mean, the craziness right. that they always are going on about.
But sovereignty. I mean, this is an issue that right-wingers who are hysterical about our surrender of sovereignty to the UN by agreeing that we will not attack countries without a UN resolution is a loss of sovereignty. This is that on steroids. The difference, though, yeah. is that the principal beneficiaries of the TPP, SHAFTA, will not be foreign governments. It'll be foreign corporations. And yeah. the Republican Party kind of institutionally never met a corporation they didn't love.
Well, and this gets me back to where I originally called about, you know, in the 60s with teach-ins. I mean, we are not getting our message out. They're not even, we're not even getting their message out. Their message is it changes on a day-to-day basis and by right. who gets the money gets out. And it's time for, you know, people to, we have to do something alternatively. The media will not cover these topics. And they right. haven't. For 10 years.
Well, you remember, Richard, the epicenter for the teach-ins in the late 60s about Vietnam and the early 70s were the universities. And the reason why it worked at those universities and those campuses was because students weren't afraid of getting in trouble. They weren't afraid of getting kicked out. There was always another school you could go to. You could always afford to get into a school. Nobody was in debt. Nobody's lives would be devastated if they flunked out of college or got kicked out of college. And or just left college, you know, and I think I did all of the above. And, you know, but now, you know, over the last 30 years, I mean, 30 years of Reaganomics and Reagan's economic policies, educational policies, Bill Bennett's, you know, we now have the echo of Education Secretary Bill Bennett basically running our. And so we've got $1 trillion in student loan debt. Students are scared to death. They're afraid of getting in trouble. You know, it'll wreck their credit score. They don't want to get arrested in a demonstration, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They have succeeded in creating a terrified class of disempowered people.
Yeah. Well, and then also in the 60s, you know, people were going to war and dying, and now we do our wars on the cheap.
That's correct.
There's another thing that goes away, but it's somehow, you know, we can't rely on the old formulas of a media that is at all even balanced.
Yeah. Yeah,
even near balance.
I would love to see teach-ins start erupting at universities all over the country, and you're actually starting to see some of these on more safe subjects that don't have where the corporation doesn't have a dog in the game. You know, things like sexual assault on campuses. But when it comes to things like foreign policy, I don't think it's going to happen. Richard, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I mean, I wish it would happen, but I'm skeptical. We'll be back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jack in Gainesville, Florida. You want to go off on Bill Clinton?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right. If we're going to talk about president, we'll talk about both of them. Okay. The foundation for the Afghanistan and Iraq war was set by the Clinton administration. So far, Afghanistan is concerned, we were attacked 4 times under Clinton. We had the first Trade Center attack. We had 2 embassy attacks, and we had the code. And they had bin Laden, who was responsible for those. They had bin Laden in the Sudan. And the president of the Sudan told Clinton to come over here, go over there and get bin Laden. And he refused to do so. And if we're going to accuse Bush of not taking the opportunity of getting bin Laden, we need to accuse Clinton of the same thing.
Well, I have no recollection, Jack. I mean, maybe you're right of the president of Sudan offering bin Laden to Bill Clinton. But I do know that during the Monica stuff that was going on, you know, the impeachment proceedings, that Bill Clinton threw 3 Tomahawk missiles into bin Laden's camp and missed bin Laden by 30 minutes. And that Newt Gingrich went on the floor of the House and said, oh, he's just trying to wag the dog. He's trying to distract us from the really important business before Congress, which is finding out about Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton getting it on in the White House. And that was, you know, that whole thing about, you know, Clinton was just using bin Laden. And Clinton came out and said, you know, no, we've got to get this guy. We've got to kill this guy. He represents a serious threat to the United States. He's responsible for other crimes against us. And this was all before 9/11. Bill Clinton was ridiculed for that by Republicans. And that's why when Bush, Cheney, and company, and Condoleezza Rice and Don Rumsfeld came into office, they ignored the Clinton administration telling them that they should be looking at bin Laden.
Well, then I go back to say, if the Sudan has him, and if they say, come get him, and you're the president of the United States, and you won't go get him.
Well, you got to, Jack, you're going to have to back that up. I have never heard that the president of Sudan offered bin Laden to anybody. I can quote you a New York Times or a Washington Post piece, an Associated Press piece, you know, clearly stating that the President Bush said no thank you when the Taliban offered to arrest bin Laden.
Wait a minute. Now I'm going to back it up with something.
Okay.
Read the book, Unveiling the Whole
Truth. To what?
To the book.
Okay. Yeah, Shano just checked out factcheck.org on this, and factcheck.org says there's a story floating around the internet about this that's used by Republicans to trash Clinton, but it has no factual basis. It's not true.
I'm going to give you some facts if you listen to me. Read the book, Unveiling the Whole Truth, by Wayne Perriman, and he'll give you the facts and the dates on that.
Okay.
Now we're going to talk about our record.
Just because it's in a book, Jack, doesn't mean it's true.
Well, but just because someone says it over here, or they says it over here, or this one says it over here, with all the this thing that's going on around here, I'm trying to find the truth about something that you say and a whole lot of other people. And if they don't write, I'm trying to find out if what they're telling the truth.
Right.
Sometimes I just said all y'all.
But if Bill Clinton was offered bin Laden, you know, by the president of Somalia and he refused to take him, then, you know, bad on him. I just don't believe that ever happened. But if it did happen, hey, you got a point.
Okay.
But at that, the other argument, though, is at that point in time, I don't think anybody, certainly in the Clinton administration, was expecting a 9/11 kind of event. Although maybe, because they were pretty freaked out. I mean, Sandy Berger was very clear with us when he was on this program after after he left the White House that they were totally. And Richard Clark wrote a whole book about it, which you might want to read. But Jack, thank you for the call. Joe in Forest Lake, Minnesota. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom, it seems kind of trivial after all your other callers, but I just want to say that you and your Twitter friend there were both kind of right about the Gulf War.
Okay.
Desert Storm, the operation, lasted a couple of months. Active hostilities only lasted 100 hours before they surrendered.
Okay. So I'm remembering my 100 hours correctly, but then there was all that cleanup and stuff around it.
That was what the buildup and the cleanup was what took all the time.
I see. Okay. Joe, so, thank you for that.
You're both kind of right.
Yeah. So. I really appreciate it. We have the smartest listeners of any show anywhere, and I'm so glad that you called. You want to say something else?
If I could add one more thing about the World Trade Towers.
Yeah.
Because all that time after the war, I spent in commercial construction, and I was actually involved in a few demolition projects. And before they put any explosives on a building, it is damn near unrecognizable as a building. So the notion.
Oh, in other words, they strip a building before they.
Explosions. Yeah, because you go in there, you jackhammer out major columns, you have to cut the steel of other members, and then place explosives to finish the job.
Right.
This isn't something that's done by just explosives. You bring it to the brink by hand.
Right, and then you use the explosives to push it over.
Finish it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Good point. Makes perfect sense. Joe, thank you for the call, and thanks for the correction or for the information. Donald in Oak Park, Illinois. Hey, Donald.
Yes, Tom?
Yeah, you're on the air.
You know, the thing is I didn't know President Obama was at this for the last 5 years. And to me, that just tells me that this is nothing but all this stuff that he's done so far is nothing but smoking mirrors. That's all it is. And that was the real goal. But you know what really upsets me? I voted for him twice. I've lost sleep almost since he's been in office with rage. I used to go to bed with rage because of what they were doing to him. And if he pulls this stuff for all the good that he did, this is going to oversee. This is going to overshadow everything. He would have outshone any president that followed him if he'd step out of that office in 2016, leaving what he has done so far. But when he starts sticking with this TTP thing, it's going to really destroy all of us. And my suggestion is to the American people, because we don't have enough of them listening, is to get the Democratic and the Republican voters better smarten up and get every single one of these bums out of office. We don't need any more of this stuff.
Well, it's not the bums in office. It's the rules of how you get into and stay in office that have been established by the Supreme Court. And those rules need to be changed. We need to say that billionaires cannot buy politicians anymore, and neither can foreign corporations or even domestic corporations. And that's pretty straightforward stuff. With regard to Obama and the TPP, I don't disagree with you. I think he's making a huge strategic and historic mistake. If you look at the Clinton presidency, the big blemish on the Clinton presidency is NAFTA and the WTO, the GATT that Clinton signed. Ross Perot was absolutely right on that. You look back at the Lyndon Johnson presidency, he was arguably one of the most progressive presidents of the 20th century. What do we remember him for? Vietnam, not the Great Society. I mean, it's like every president seems to have, you know, some place where they stuck their foot in quicksand and got in trouble. And I really hope that we can save Obama from himself. I think this may also be a symptom of a situation or of a reality, a political reality, where in order to run for president and win, or run for reelection and win, you have to raise $1 billion. If you have to raise $1 billion, you know, the old saying, lay down with dogs, get up with fleas. You've got to take money from people who are going to say, I want a pound of flesh. And it looks like this TPP is the pound of flesh that they want from him. And I'm so disappointed, but also, you know, I get it, how the political system works in this town. And I don't consider that the fault of the president or the Democratic Party or anybody else who's an elected politician right now. I consider it the fault of the Supreme Court. But, Donald, your point is well made. Thank you for calling and making it. Shirley in Wheeling, West Virginia. Hey, Shirley.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to call and give you breaking news. I saw on our local news last night in Wheeling, West Virginia, Green Hunter is the name of the company, and they are a big gas industry group. They were given approval by our state to haul on barges drilling waste materials down the Ohio River. Thanks. And I fit to be tied. And if you want to find out more about the story, you can find it on WTRF or WTOV. And they've gotten approval from the state to haul the waste literally on the river, which is amazing to me, because who can even think how many accidents could happen with that kind of criteria? And we do have some protesters here, but they're not on the news and they're not being heard. So I thought I'd bring it to your attention.
Yeah. Well, well done, Shirley. Thank you. Thanks for the heads up on that. We'll have to dig into that.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. Bill in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Bill, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, buddy. Yeah, I've been patient, and we've been listening to you for years, and we love you dearly. You guys started talking about the Twin Towers, and your secretary told me to hold it to one thing. I
Please.
Said, okay, one thing, Twin Towers, 9/11. I was at home. I saw it immediately start. Everybody's watching California with this stupid court case about some guy killed his wife. And the way the press jumped on it, and when I saw the planes, anybody that's in America that's ever flown, we all knew it was wrong. It was proven to me, like you just said, Richard Clark, Against All Enemies. I have his book, and it precisely tells me precisely who was running the White House. It wasn't Bush. It was Cheney.
Yep.
But we love your book, The Crash 16. And my bud really went into it, and I've been, like, walking on eggshells. And I showed him something else that matches your book. And it's a gentleman that's called Jim Richards. And then he's got a book called The Death of Money and Project Prophecy.
Yeah.
And just the charts that he shows, it's like, oh, good Lord, we need to get big business out.
Yeah, well, we need to get it out of control anyway. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for the call. Yeah, I mean, there's, for example, Staples is going to buy, you know, one of the other big office supply, Office Depot, I guess it is. This is something that a decade ago, the the federal government said no.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The Department of Justice Antitrust Division, back during the Clinton administration, said you can't merge. It will be a violation of the antitrust laws. It's going to create a monopoly. No, yeah, no problem. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Scott, watching Free Speech TV in Canaan, Maine. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Oh, hang on, Tom. Let me get you off speaker.
Okay. You got a pretty good speakerphone there. I could not have.
Yeah, heard. I had it on. I was doing other things. So,
yeah. So what's up, Scott?
Listen, I was going to give you some other people that you're probably aware of, like James Corbett. There's a frequent guest on RT that you're probably familiar with. Abby Martin, who's also on that channel as well.
Yeah, I know Abby.
This is on the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
And the architects and engineers is not a secret cabal or whatever. They're very much professional people who have some very good insights on what happened to those buildings. But I'm not going to waste your time with that anymore because there's enough people telling you about it. But it's something for you to look at.
No, I'm familiar with that. I'm familiar with the arguments. I've had David Ray Griffin on this program a number of times. In fact, I just wrote a blurb for his most recent book. He's a good guy.
I know I'm limited on time here, but with the TPP thing here, man, I'm right behind you on that. Obama's talking about saving the middle class. And if he lets that TPP thing go through, he's going to destroy it, absolutely destroy it. The Republicans want it. He wants it. I don't see how we're going to get out of it. I mean, that's the loss of our
society. Well, we get out of it by having all of us call, every single one of us needs to call both our senators and our member of the House of Representatives and say no to fast track.
Tom, you know, I think it's too late. I really do, because he wants it. He's been after it. And now the Republicans.
I don't think it's too late.
They all want it.
No, no. There's a bunch of Tea Partiers who are opposed to it.
Yeah. I'm just afraid that if it goes through, you know, that will be the end.
Well, Scott, translate that fear into action. Translate that fear into action. Call your elected officials and let us know what happens. You've got two senators from Maine. You've got a member of the House of Representatives. Call each one of their offices and say, I'm opposed to TPP. I'm opposed to fast track authority. I think that the fast track authority is unconstitutional. I think TPP is a bad deal. What is, you know, Senator so and so going to do? What is Angus King going to do about this? I mean, you know, call and ask their offices.
I've gone beyond that, you know, beyond them. I mean, consistently, I've gone after Senator King because he actually calls me back.
But they're the ones who are going to have to either approve or disapprove fast track authority. And right now, I don't think Obama has the votes for fast track authority. And I'm very skeptical it's going to happen.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right, but I'm just afraid he does, you know.
Well, it's going to be the people who are going to get the votes are John Boehner and Mitch McConnell. And they are both twisting arms like crazy right now in the Republican caucuses. And, you know, the big challenge is not going to be the House, because I think Boehner can get it through the House without a problem. The big challenge is going to be the Senate. And we really need the Democratic senators to hold a filibuster on this thing so that, you know, there's not more than 60 votes for it. And,
You know,
it's going to be tough, but because there's a flood of money coming. I mean, this is going to be multi-trillion dollar deal. And so, you know, the oligarchs, they'll invest hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion, in lobbying for this, which is really bad stuff. Scott, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network there in Maine. We will be right back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Freeman in San Diego. Hey, Freeman, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have to say that the listener of 10 years is getting increasingly harder to call you, and for that I'll say congratulations to you.
Okay. Thank you.
But so my issue is that just because we don't, as a 9/11 thing, just because we don't know what happened doesn't mean that the official story is accurate. So like I heard you say, you know, well, what happened to the plane if a plane didn't hit the Pentagon? It's like, well, we don't know, but we could still look at the Pentagon and the wreckage and say, well, that doesn't appear to be a plane. And just because we don't know how explosives got into the World Trade Center doesn't mean that there weren't explosives there, or that somehow, you know, we can close our eyes and say, oh, jet fuel miraculously took down this, you know, giant steel story building. You know, same thing with World Trade Center 7. So okay. that's my big issue. It's like, I love you, but I don't like hearing you argument or hear you argue like Republicans do.
Well, I don't think this is Republican Democrat, and
No.
I'm unconvinced of the conspiracy theory that you're embracing. That said, you know, I'm not totally trashing it. I just, you know, I don't believe that the official story is right either. But I'm with Bob Graham and Bob Kerry saying, hey, at the very least, release the 28-page document that shows that the Saudis are involved in this thing. I mean, there's
sure. So
you know,
what
go ahead.
Yeah. What was the I've heard someone mention it. It was one of your callers about 10, 15 minutes ago. Something about this is now a theory on how, you know, the World Trade Center fell, like something about the wind blown as a weak structure. I definitely like to learn about that.
Yeah, I didn't hear that. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
The American Society of Civil Engineers, I think, was something that one of our previous callers said looked into this and said, yeah, you know, it collapsed the way you would expect it to collapse if it was hit by an airplane at that floor with that amount of jet fuel. And, you know, I think that that's fairly solid. But you know, the point is not, you know, what happened on 9/11. The point is that the Bush administration did absolutely nothing to prevent it when they had more than enough information to stop it. And then they exploited that tragedy mercilessly to get us into two illegal, unnecessary wars. And the consequence of those wars, the consequence of Ronald Reagan creating the Mujahideen, the consequence of, you know, 40 years of foreign policy supporting or actually 100 years of foreign policy supporting Saudi Arabia is ISIS. It's these disasters in the Middle East. We helped create these. And if we don't acknowledge that and start asking, you know, our future actions, for example, you know, the drone strikes that we're doing right now in Pakistan, are these going to cause more blowback or are they going to solve the problem? And I just don't think that we're asking the right questions or doing our due diligence. Freeman, thank you for the call. I gotta move along here. We just have a few minutes, and I got a whole board full of callers. Shane in Palm Coast, Florida. Hey, Shane, what's up?
I just wonder why they need to fast track this if they've the TPP if they've been talking about it for 5 years.
Right, that's a good question, and the reason they have to fast track it is because if this thing was not fast, you know, what fast track does is it eliminates the ability of Congress to have any meaningful debate on the issue. It eliminates their ability to amend the law or the treaty, and you know, it just basically gets rammed through. And the reason why they want to do fast track is because they know if there was a debate, if people knew what was in this, that would be the end of it. It would go down in flames.
That's horrible.
Yeah, it really and truly is. And this was Richard Nixon's brilliant idea, and it's coming back to haunt us. And right now it's not the law of the land, and Boehner and McConnell are going to try and make it the law of the land, and Obama too. And we have to say no, this is going to ruin America. Thank you, Shane, for the call. Rod in Forest Lake, Minnesota. Hey, Rod.
Hey, Tom. Long time listener.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about the Twin Towers and the mathematics behind it.
Mm-hmm.
The airplanes hit at two different places, and neither one of them penetrated the same distance. And then the fuel burns at 700 degrees. And to melt steel that's coated with at least 6 inches of insulation, you need way more heat than that.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between have you ever seen a blowtorch? The end of a blowtorch.
Yeah, I work demolition also.
You can get a couple thousand degrees out of a blowtorch when you're blowing propane or butane through it. Propane, butane, and these other, you know, high fraction natural gases, their ignition temperature is around 700 degrees, the same as paper. In fact, arguably their ignition temperatures are below that. But that doesn't mean that that's the temperature that they always burn at. If you just have a leak, you know, a very low velocity without any, you know, ancillary oxygen added to it, a low velocity leak, yeah, you're going to get a 700 degree burn. But you start, you turn the, you know, a couple of floors of buildings like the Twin Towers into a giant smokestack. I mean, it's the same thing with a wood fire. You blow enough air across it and it starts producing enormous amounts of heat. It's burning at higher than the ignition temperature of wood.
What about below it?
What about below it? When the floors above it started collapsing, they just pancaked all the way down.
Right. That's what they say, right? So every nut, bolt, piece of rebar, different thickness, everything had to collapse perfectly, sandwiching 100 stories.
I think the buildings were designed for that,
Rod. Also building number 7.
The buildings...
Building number 7 is another building the same gentleman owned that collapsed.
Right. With 20,000 gallons of diesel fuel on his top floor that was caught on fire. They had their generators in the roof on building 7.
We don't know if it all got there. And there's another building nobody talks about. Building number 7 collapsed also. And
that's what I just said.
Third airplane.
Yeah. You know, I thanks a lot for the call, Rod. I don't want to be doing 9/11 truth stuff here. I mean, it's not that I don't want to do it. It's like it becomes a circle. I think, you know, whether there was some bizarre conspiracy with the building owner and Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush or not, I don't really care. It's American foreign policy that has created this disaster in the Middle East that we need to deal with. And dealing with, you know, and using war and violence to try to resolve war and violence is, in my opinion, in this case, the wrong strategy. So, enough said. Anyhow, don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.